Good afternoon, welcome. I'd like to open the Senate Committee on Education and Workforce Development. Honored today, once again, to have the House Subcommittee on Higher Education with us today. Representative, do you want to gavel in?
Call into order the House Subcommittee on Higher Education for an informational hearing with our compadres on the Senate side, so we're thankful to be here.
Well, thank you. I was hoping that we would go no longer beyond 2:30 today in our public hearing on these three bills before us, 242, 253, and 254, and I guess that's a subtle reminder for those of you who are speaking to be careful in condensing, highlighting your points. And then at that point, or before, we'll gavel out and we'll go into a work session on 253 in the House Subcommittee can dismiss itself. So let me open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 242, 253, and 254 simultaneously. And we'll start off with some of Oregon's business associations, Betsy Earle, Bill Perry, Ryan Deckard. They're here.
Just send them on up.
Bill would be the guy packing the food.
This is a powerful trio here. Steam group. Welcome.
I guess I'll start. Mr. Chairs, members of the committees, for the record, I'm Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries, appearing before you in support of Senate Bill 242. AOI supports the work of the Legislative Task Force on Higher Education and the concepts that are embodied in Senate Bill 242. AOI represents over 1,600 employers in the state of Oregon, and all of those companies are depending on today's students to fulfill their future workforce needs, which we hope will be many. If we would like Oregon students to be able to meet the needs of those companies, we must provide them with access to the educational opportunities that allow them to do so. Senate Bill 242 restructures the governance of our higher education system in a way that allows it to address the state's requirements for skilled and capable workers. Under current law, the legislature provides very little of the state university system's operating costs, but exercises near total control over university budgets, tuition policies, and even programs. This lack of autonomy limits the university's ability to innovate, reduce costs, and find alternative sources of revenue, and the net result is a system that's rapidly losing the ability to deliver affordable, quality education to Oregon students. By providing the system with more autonomy, Senate Bill 242 also provides the flexibility to meet education goals as affordably as we possibly can. The bill allows the legislature to identify overall state policy for higher education by setting standards for enrollment and graduation rates, and in turn, universities have the flexibility to decide how to meet those standards through a series of performance agreements. By following the direction and the goals that are provided in Senate Bill 242, it is our position that Oregon will effectively be saying that economic and job growth are at the very top of our mutual political agendas. It's clear that the bill still needs a few details to be worked out, but we do urge your support of the direction and the goals of Senate Bill 242. And if you have questions, I'm happy to answer.
Take questions after you all three present.
Okay. Thank you, Chairs Haas, Johnson, and Dembro. For the record, Bill Perry at the Oregon Restaurant and Lodging Association. And I handed out the written testimony, and so I'll just kind of briefly run over a few highlights. First of all, I enjoyed the consultants coming in yesterday, and I thought they did a very good job, agree with a lot of the concepts that they brought up, and heard them, obviously, several times, as most of you did over the interim when we met in the task force. From our perspective, we agree with 40-40-20, but the piece that I want to address today is really kind of the higher ed piece of 242. Because as of right now, in my testimony, it talks about we have about 160,000 employees and about $6.9 billion in sales every year. When I went to Oregon State back in the 80s, we had hospitality programs at Oregon State, PSU, and Southern Oregon. By the time, 10 years later, we didn't didn't have any hospitality programs in the university system. And it was, as the chancellor talked about in the 90s, with the shrinking funding, they consolidated and tried to force everybody into a business degree, which provides good education, but is a growing industry. You want to basically keep your best and brightest going here instead of going to the hospitality schools at Washington State or UNLV. But if you look at the scenario we have today, we now have a hospitality program again. It's at the Cascades campus. And there's about 700 students. They really need to get it to about 2,000 in the long run. And the way the system works today is, say, for some miraculous reason, I get all those students to apply next year. The way they're limited on the other funds, tuition caps, they may not be able to keep all that money if it wasn't budgeted. And so the tuition cap part of this bill, in my opinion, has to pass. I think there's a lot of things that we can address otherwise, but I want to stress for the committee, if we are going to grow under 40-40-20 at larger than we expected in this budget, we can't penalize the schools and not have them have that commitment to be able to keep that money. So that, I think, is a fundamental principle we need to make sure passes, just urging, because as we're growing new colleges at the university level and we attract those students, we have to make sure that we're able to keep that money. And so the higher ed kind of statewide system that allows them to manage their other funds, I would say, is a fundamental piece as we grow colleges, that business groups like ours is, I want to stress the importance. And so we can talk about some of the others as questions, but to limit time, I'll just say that fundamentally, I think, is where we need to make sure we get before session goes home in early June.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. Chair, Chair Johnson, Chair Dembro, and members of the House and Senate Education Committee, Ryan Deckert with the Oregon Business Association. So I largely, entirely agree with what, although the UNLV part I'm less versed in terms of hospitality training, the sentiments of, and why the business community has been so engaged in this issue and the work that was done in the interim by the Joint Task Force. If I could, and I understand you are somewhat PowerPointed out after Tuesday, but it is short, brief, and hopefully to the point and not duplicative of information that was shared in PowerPoint. So if I could, hopefully it would provide some explanation of why we are so engaged in this issue, and it's risen to such a level of prominence, at least within the business community, and so much time was spent in concert with the work that you were doing here in Salem and in Corvallis and Portland with the Joint Task Force. So the first slide really addresses the fundamental issue that's facing Oregon, which is the per capita income issue. It is why, as we look at it across the country and certainly with our peers in Washington, why does the state of Oregon continue to lag behind the national average in per capita income, and particularly in Washington? And since we paid them, I can say the good work that Eco Northwest was able to find with Washington was it was that dearth of A, higher education investment, and the good effects that that brings, particularly in the Washington economy. And so it is, you need to look no further than the University of Washington, smart investment that's almost 2.5x times what Oregon's been able to invest in their higher education system, and what that's burgeoned, which is your trade, a more healthy, vibrant traded sector economy that grows all the other ancillary jobs that are high-wage jobs within. So whether it be accountants, lawyers, they tend to drive your per capita income up, and that's the difference between Oregon and Washington, is they just have a richer blend of traded sector, from agriculture to Fortune 500 Microsoft or software. The second slide really continues to make that point, is that educational attainment, when folks go to measure the wealth of a society, the first thing they look at is educational attainment levels, and that will be the greatest indicator or barometer of wealth of a society, is the educational attainment levels. And we, obviously, in Oregon, and that's 40-40-20, and the work of this committee is about, is trying to drive those attainment levels higher, which will drive your and actually make divvying up the state budget a lot easier. The third is the Oregon story, and so I know everyone on this committee is familiar with the Oregon story, but if you look at who's winning and losing in the state budget in our state compared to our peers in the West, the winners have been unequivocally corrections, where we've doubled the budget, human services, which is seen anywhere from 15% to 25% increases, and it's all come on the backs of, and you can almost do it in a dollar-for-dollar basis. It's come from your post-secondary system. And so we would argue that that is the wrong, that we've got to inverse the relationship, that you drive your education budget should produce better resources for human services and less need. Corrections outstanding. The next slide is the result of the disinvestment, which, again, following your task force, I know you spent a lot of time on what that has led to in terms of disinvestment in our higher education system, but it simply has led to fewer qualified workers, fewer entrepreneurs, and fewer folks that are ready to compete in this knowledge economy. Four more slides to go. The next slide is some scenario planning we did collectively around, well, what's this legislature, as you deliberate over the next budget, what you're up against. And so, as you see, if we do, as a state, business as usual, which is the areas that are growing continue to grow, and we tried to slow down the growth in some of these, the big four. So we tried to slow down the growth in health and human services on this slide. As you can see, we tried to slow the growth in corrections. Then the governor outlined on Monday some of the ways that he would go about slowing that growth in the corrections budget. You eat the PERS increased costs, which are none. Those are just the $431 million that's going to be on the table. You do 0% growth in K-12, and that necessitates a 54% cut in post-secondary education, just going off legislative revenue forecast and if you divvied up the budget. And so we talked collectively a great deal about that in the interim, of what a disaster that would be for Oregon to just really dismantle your post-secondary system and your university system with a 54% cut when we're already around 46th or 47th in per capita per student funding. I don't know. We would probably surpass Guam at that point in terms of where we stand in the 50 states. So the next slides are really the work that you've led on as a committee and as a legislature, and it really is the need for reform. It seems, and I guess Bill made this point, but it does seem very real that we have more of an opportunity, and that's where the last three slides end. Collectively, we seem to have more of an opportunity to marshal the forces for bold, innovative change. Obviously, starting with the contents of the bill, we do have a few areas that we are not aligned, but for the most part are aligned, and we just think this legislature has the opportunity, it seems, with the wind at your back, to do real, fundamental, bold rethinking of the relationship between the state and our post-secondary system, and our view would be take it. Take it and run as you are, as far and as fast as you can go. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank all three of you. Comments or questions of our panel today?
Thank you, Mr. Chairs. Excuse me. One of the things that scares me to death on this earth, in this life, is when everybody agrees. And I've been listening to this for a long time, and I have yet to meet someone that disagrees with this proposal. But I have personally. I'm waiting to meet him. Maybe I'll meet some now.
They'll be greeting you after the meeting.
Yeah. could one of you just highlight a couple of the cons? What are the cons?
I guess I'll be the blunt one to take the bullet or the shot in the back. Just tell me. I mean, no, I don't think there's a con. I mean, the issue I think that is going to be the fundamental debate for you guys to decide is, what does statewide control mean? I really think that that's a fundamental, because if you're going to look at 40-40-20, and, you know, I outlined the thing with the hospitality school. This is just one school. It gives you a specific example. I think there's a lot of people that have either lost their schools, lost some vocational ed. So then the question is your overarching system over post-secondary, does it include higher ed, community colleges, and an OHSU. I mean, that's what the consultant said you should probably do. Now, obviously, you put everybody under one umbrella. A lot of them aren't going to like the controls. I mean, good, bad, or indifferent. And so the question is how much control do you put over all three? If you put strong control, the chances of us getting a bill out of this building are unlikely. So that's why I tried to stress in my comments, this is my personal view, they might feel differently, you have to do the tuition freedom for higher ed. That piece has to. Now, what control outside of that happens is really more of, I hate to say it, a political debate than anything else. And so I don't know, you know, if that answers your question, but I do think it's, you know, I think the consultants have said, if you've got 40-40-20, you have to have somebody that's going to make sure all the industries and schools meet their objectives. But once you start doing that, you're going to make a lot of the separate entities a little bit nervous when they have somebody above them telling them how to operate. So I don't know if that answers your question. These two might feel differently, but I don't know if it's a con, but it's just at what level. And I just think for 40-40-20, my personal view is having somebody to make sure all the objectives are met is a good thing, but at the same token, we need tuition freedom. I mean, we need that. That has to happen. And I think if everything else gets bogged down, we lose a great opportunity. So,
I guess if I could add to that, I would say that again, for the record, Betsy Earls from AOI, I would be concerned that people mistake our primary concern here is that the higher ed system is able to maintain or gain some financial autonomy from state agency status, but I wouldn't want anybody to confuse that with the concern that higher education in the state as a whole needs more funding. I don't mean to imply by our support for giving the system more autonomy that we think that will stand in for more funding. We simply recognize that the state's facing huge funding crises this session, and we feel that this is probably the most important place we could start. But don't mistake, I think, any of our message for the idea that we think they're doing fine financially, actually, because we don't think that.
I might add, Representative, last summer, you would have found a whole long list of people on this issue who would have been in that camp. And so we're continuing to stick our fingers in dikes to try to make sure that, you know, drafting errors and those kinds of things, just, you know, 180 pages worth of changes to accommodate as many people as we can and still get to where we are. But you should also know, and we talked about this a lot in the task force, there's truth to the saying that you can marshal an army to preserve the status quo. And throughout this process, I'm sure Senator Morris and Tobias Reed and I have heard from a whole lot of people on this, and the conversation always seems to start, we love what you're doing, it's long overdue, but don't change our little slice of the universe. And if we tried to accommodate all of those people that came to us, we wouldn't have a bill. So some of this is change that not everybody is 100% down with. Some of it, I think, Ms. Perry put it well, we have to do this. This bill overall, this concept, we have to do this. Not everybody's going to love everything about it, as is the case in most of the bills that pass out of here. Other questions, comments, Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ryan, I just wanted to thank you for bringing up the topic of corrections. I wanted to bring to the attention of the rest of the committee that when I was one of the co-chairs of the public safety sub, what we found is that another thing that was happening in Washington is that they were incarcerating about 280 of their residents per 100,000 versus 380 per 100,000 in Oregon, a very significant increase in incarcerating our population here versus Washington. And Dave Frohmeyer came and presented to our public safety sub in 2007 showing essentially the inverse relationship between the increase in corrections funding and the decline in funding for higher education over the 90s and since over 2000 as well. So I just wanted to bring that to the committee's attention because I'm on a policy committee now, and that'll be something for those of you who are on judiciary to have to wrestle with.
Representative Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to reference or refer back to Washington, state to the north, that you referenced in terms of a target where that we might aim at. There's a bill up there now being introduced by Reuven Carlisle, who is the representative from the Ballard District, to further increase significantly their support of higher ed and to deal with some of the same issues that we're talking about here. So it's one of these cases where we should not try to aim too low. We should aim as high as we possibly can in this time, because I for one, agree with you, Ryan, as representative of OBA, and perhaps it's because that's the organization my business belongs to, but we should go for it as much as we possibly can. Take this great work and see if we can push that through and maybe even some more.
Well, we very much appreciate your help and here today through this session and through last year in helping us shape this, and we've got miles to go before we sleep.
Can I, Mr. Chair, if I could just say one thing, because it's 11, 15-minute appointments, if I don't take that up, 20-second opportunity. And in some ways, it's exactly what you just mentioned, though. The Great Oregon tradition is to everyone wins in post-secondary. And we would argue, at times, no one wins. It leads to lesser choice. And so if it would, I think if everyone wins, the state as a whole doesn't move forward. And so I encourage the comments that you made, that if at the end, if everyone's got pom-poms, Representative Lindsay, that would be an indicator that perhaps we didn't push this as far as we could have.
Thank you. Okay, let's go to the community colleges. I know that we have PCC President Preston Williams here, and John Wyckoff is here. President Williams, thank you.
Thank you for the invitation. Good afternoon to all, to Mr. Chairman, to Co-Chair Johnson and Co-Chair Dembro, and all the committee members. I'm Preston Williams. I'm District President of Portland Community College. I've served in that role for some 7 years now. I also serve as current chair of the Oregon President's Council, and also a member of the Board of Higher Ed for the State of Oregon. I do want to recognize two in the room with me. My board chair, Mr. David Squire, is here. Ms. Squire, please raise your hand. Thank you very much. And also recognize our vice chair, Jim Harper, vice chair of our board, who's also here in support of my statements. I will be very brief in terms of stating our support for Senate Bill 242 and 253 and 254. Reaction to Bill 242, I just want to publicly acknowledge and thank Mr. Chairman, you, for your willingness to work with community college sector. We've had a number of conversations about this bill and about how we're about our mission and your support for that. We thank you for that. We especially thank you for your support of local governance and understanding how that works and represents our service area and how that relates to the mission of our college. My sense is that the Coordinating Commission proposal has a great set of goals that will work certainly toward the benefit of higher education and certainly toward the benefit of community colleges. I also want to acknowledge Representative Tobias Reed for his leadership as well. In support of Senate Bill 253, 40-40-20, I'll just simply say that this is a sense of a visionary approach, that this bill will indeed make Oregon more competitive internationally and also in the global economy and marketplace. In support of Senate Bill 254, dual credit, I also want to thank you, all the committee members, for understanding the critical partnership that goes on between community colleges and high schools. We serve a 5-county district centered around Portland, and we have many, many partnerships, and the foundation of these partnerships often are dual credit programs. These programs are also very popular with parents of young college-going students because they save money and they give students a kind of a jump and a good foundation in terms of entering higher education, community colleges, and our state universities. We are particularly proud of our efforts to share example of one program we have is of our middle college program, where we're working very closely with Portland Public Schools and Jefferson High School, which is challenged by the fact that not enough of those students in that high school are able to go on to higher education or to their local community college. They're challenged in a number of ways. Part of it's budgetary, but part of it is also, I think, since that we can add a new creative structure to that program. This is just one example of partnerships that we're working to enter to certainly support our K-12 district in Portland. I just want to conclude again by thanking Mr. Chairman, you and the committee for your consideration. Allow me to share a few remarks this afternoon. I'll be prepared for questions.
Well, we appreciate that very much. I think your institution boasts more students than any other community college or university. And
yes, sir. Mr. Chair, we will serve individually, head counted for the entire year, about 94,000 individual students in all our programs. So it is a big program. It is a big district. But we're also partnering with lots of folks in our community and throughout the state in terms of education.
Questions? Comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chairman, I guess my honest coming new into this issue is, when you look at community colleges right now, they're sort of separate from the university system as far as how you access. Just PR-wise, when people think of higher education, they think of the Ducks and Beavers because they got great football teams. I mean, that's just the way it is. That's the state and that's the public. Are you at all concerned about once community colleges kind of come into the same situation with the big universities, that you could be swamped or that your voice could be diminished at all? And how do you see that interacting with this bill?
Oh, well, first of all, I feel that community colleges indeed can hold their own, particularly in terms of our history of responding to community needs. Our missions are somewhat different from the university, and that's just fine. But really, in the end, we all have to be strategic and work together. If the university system is not successful or the K-12 system is not successful, we're not going to be successful. So I see this as a way of better coordinating how we can work together. We have a number, and I could take a long time to talk about all our relationships we have and all our articulation agreements where we're working together. One of my roles on the Board of Higher Education is to represent the mission of a community college and how it can engage and work closely with our higher ed system. So, no, I'm not. I happen to be a Wolverine from the University of Michigan, so I'm not that excited about Ducks and Beavers anyway. But saying that, again, we've certainly appreciate a place at the table, and we can hold our own.
Further questions, comments?
Thank you, Senator Hassan. Following up on Senator George's question, you know, of course, I'm very familiar with your biography, Mr. President, since I was on your search committee at the college. It was one of, I must say, one of our better selections over the years.
Well, thank you very much, Representative.
Let's limit the sucking up.
Yeah. Now, that's the prologue to the tough part of the question. Right. Yeah. So I know that you had a prior experience in New York where you were involved in a joint kind of governing board with the university and community colleges. And there you were kind of you were a lone voice for community colleges in that context,
mm-hmm.
right? And there were probably some difficulties with that. And one of the features of what we're talking about in terms of a coordinating commission is a group that is not, you know, it's not a university. The members there are not representing university. They're not representing community colleges. They're representing the needs of Oregonians for post-secondary education throughout the state. So by its very structure, one would think that that's a better setup, one that's more prone to success than the one that you had. But are there other things that you would sort of caution us about as we're looking at creating this new coordinating commission that you think we should be keeping in mind?
Mr. Chair and Representative Dimbrough, my response to that is that I think the key to this, to make this really work and be successful, is, again, to respect and understand that, again, we are linked and we coordinate very well with the university system as a community college sector. But we have two different missions in a way. We really tie in and tie everything that we do is based upon the need of our service area. So my institution be very distinct from an institution along the coast or in Southern Oregon because it's a different community with different needs. That's the key for us. But also, many of our students, probably the majority of them that enter our doors at some point, will transfer to one of the state universities. 6% of our graduates end up at Portland State University. We have a great relationships there. So as long as we understand in terms, my sense, and I also saw this in New York, is that we keep in mind that the missions at some time are quite different, the service of the population is quite different, how we go about our business, but at the same time, there's a need to coordinate. I think that's where Oregon is really would benefit with us working closer together.
Okay. Mr. President, thank you.
All right.
Senator Morris, are you?
Thank you. I do have one question. If you look at the statute, the commission is granted rulemaking authority for the laws that are assigned to it. And I think that, as I understand from some of the community colleges, there's some angst over how deep those rules might go into the operations of the independent institutions. Could you speak to your perspective of that concern?
Well, quite honestly, the theme of my testimony is to support the bill as written at this point. There have been some added or changed amendments, and we've reviewed those and worked very closely with OCCA and the Oregon's President's Council, so we're very comfortable with where the bill is at this point.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
We cut off the Oregon Student Association the other day, so maybe Emma or Emma, if you could come up. I should mention, too, as she comes up, that because of the hearing the other day, we are drafting, and there are a couple of amendments in the works, two or three, mostly technical. One of them, I see Alan Contreras here, is as a result of the Student Assistance Commission, that where we will spell out and identify your good work and the statutory obligations and responsibilities of the Office of Degree Authorization. And so that was very helpful. And so those take time. They're not quite ready yet, but they're coming. Welcome.
Great. Thank you very much for having me back. Chair Haas, members of the Senate Education Committee, and members of the House Higher Ed Subcommittee, thank you for allowing me to speak today. My remarks are brief, but we'll continue to set up meetings and have conversations as time goes on. My name is Emma Calloway. I'm the Legislative Director for the Oregon Student Association, and OSA represents over 100,000 students across the state in post-secondary education. Currently, Oregon is 44th in the nation for funding per student, and students are graduating with an average of $24,000 in debt. That number can be hard to picture for a lot of people, but the way that students talk about it often is that this hardship is reflected by students unable to continue their education right away or unable to find financial freedom that would allow them to purchase a house or really contribute back to the state. These are all concerns for students and the long-term stability of this state. We very much appreciate the hard work of this committee and the challenging decisions you have ahead of you. OSA has been committed to collaborative work over the last year, and we have tried to help the best ideas rise to the top. And at this time, students have five principles. Student support, legislative checks and balances, including tuition regulation through budget notes to maintain accountability. Student support, maintaining the State Board of Higher Education as a statewide governing board and opposes local or institutional boards. Student support, keeping interest earnings on tuition on campus, securing OUS ending fund balances and protecting funds from budget sweeps, and we ask that the university system and state prioritize financial aid with money maintained in ending funds and interest earnings. We appreciate the work of the Oregon legislature to maintain some of the lowest tuition increases in the country in the last couple years. Our neighbors in Washington and California have done away with much of their legislative participation, and tuition has skyrocketed. 32% increases in California and 14% in Washington. Even though our general fund allocations are much lower than we'd like them to be, students still appreciate the positive involvement that the legislature has had in keeping tuition increases to a minimum. Students have been very clear about their opposition to local boards and Senate Bill 559, which is the University of Oregon's new partnership. This February 2010, the National Center for Public Policy and Higher Education published a policy alert regarding indicators of increased graduation rates. And they stated, states that use a single board to govern all four-year institutions are much more likely to have higher graduation rates compared with those states with mixed governance arrangements. Not surprisingly, state investments and higher levels of need-based financial aid were at the top of the list for states with top graduation rates. Also making the top of the list were statewide governance structures, and we are especially glad to see a discussion of systems rather than individual institutions. We hope that continues. Affordability is most important to us and to many stakeholders around the room, and students are still looking for parts in the bill that help maintain accountability to an affordable education. Students would like the support of the legislature to formalize a student-inclusive tuition-setting process that includes legislative input on the level of tuition so that Oregon families can have an opportunity to weigh in on what is affordable. We value the cost-cutting measures of the bill, and students believe that tuition dollars and general fund allocation should stay with our universities and community colleges. Students have raised questions around elected officials staying involved in the process, and students maintain a space to voice concerns when they arise. Finally, OSA wants to maintain a democratic, publicly accountable process. And there are still concerns that we still have some concerns. But we'll be bringing those to you as time goes on, and we do want to maintain a collaborative process, as I stated. Even based on the governor's recommendations and many other proposed amendments, we can tell that there's still a lot to talk about. Students will be continuing to ask questions and weigh in. We would like to express some concern over how quickly this bill is moving, and it can be challenging for me and students to get together and comment on amendments when bills move very, very quickly, and we do want to maintain students' involvement in this process. There are greater ideas around the table, but a change of this magnitude deserves a lot of debate in this session, and students have more to determine. We appreciate being involved in the process. Most of all, we will continue to collaborate and work towards positive change. And Representative Lindsay, not to be flip or funny in any way, but students do have some concerns, and we'll hopefully be setting up a meeting to talk to you about some of those in the future. And we do have some ideas that we'd like to bring. We want to make sure that we're working proactively to come up with ideas to share and not just bring concerns without ideas to make amendments. So with that, I can take any questions. We don't have a formal stance at this time, but I did want to share with you the main concerns from students so far and our principals, just while I have all of you in the room together.
Thank you, Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, you said something that struck a nerve, and that was you said that graduation percentages are higher under single or I guess lower for multi-governance models. Are you able to expand on that a little bit? If not, we can visit later offline.
Yeah, that just came from the National Center for Public Policy. That's where we get a lot of our research. I can bring you more research maybe in a more formal meeting setting, but it's my understanding that when we have a statewide perspective, we are able to move students through community colleges, maybe to universities, or help maintain this idea of affordability even when students have to change universities within a state or feel more comfortable moving universities. So those are all reasons that contribute to why we appreciate larger system models than local boards. And we also see that often local boards have a harder time being accountable to affordability, and that's one of our main concerns. And we think that a system and accountability to the legislature helps maintain affordability.
Other questions? I do want to note, Emma, and I know you know this, that perhaps the biggest issue with students is what happens to their tuition money.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
biggest components of this legislation is that it will protect students' tuition money from sweeps from the legislature,
mm-hmm.
which is not unprecedented, and given the times we're in, is maybe not even unlikely. And the same with tuition earnings. So whenever I talk to students, that's a pretty big concern. And that has been addressed here pretty convincingly. So.
Right. It is one of our five principles. We do appreciate that part of the bill.
And we have two students mm-hmm. on the coordinating committee. So, okay. We'll keep working with us. We appreciate it.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I have Gary Ann Dean from the Oregon Independent Colleges Association.
Good afternoon, Chairman Hass. Gary Ann Dean, the president of the Oregon Independent Colleges Association, representing all 20 of the regionally accredited nonprofit institutions of higher education mm-hmm. in Oregon, and speaking not only on their behalf, but also on behalf of another 10 or 12 institutions that are not regionally accredited, but still count in the numbers that we track around here. I'm pleased to support the general direction of SB 242 on behalf of our institutions. Our institutions generate about a third of all the baccalaureate and graduate degrees in the state, and over 10% of all the associate degrees in the state. Among those degrees, the three highest number categories are business, education, and health professions, three critical manpower areas for Oregon. Over the past 20 years, growth in enrollment and in degree output in Oregon's private higher education sector parallels that in the two public sectors, the state universities and the community colleges. We will be as much a part of reaching 40-40-20 as will state institutions and community colleges. Among our Oregonian students, the independent colleges share similar student income profiles with our state universities, as well as similar ethnic distributions, age distributions, gender distributions, and part-time distributions. Approximately half of our Oregon Opportunity Grant recipients at our independent colleges started their careers at community colleges. Anticipating comments that were made during Tuesday's hearing from Senator George, I believe it was, we have prepared a possible amendment to the bill that would add an important goal to the coordinating commission. Namely, in Section 8, Sub 2, we propose adding a goal that would read something along the lines of utilizing the resources and enhancing the capacity of the state's private nonprofit educational institutions and other organizations dedicated to helping Oregonians successfully access and complete post-secondary education. I've shared this proposal with a number of other stakeholders, and so far I've met no resistance. I think everybody thinks this would be a friendly amendment, and it would open the doors for the Coordinating Commission to not only think about my institutions, but also about many, many, many other organizations that are dedicated to access and affordability. What comes to mind are the Oregon Community Foundation, the Ford Family Foundation, Rotary Clubs, and all kinds of other people out there in Oregon who are thinking about and trying to contribute to the goal of college access and success. I'll take any questions. Appreciate the time.
Thank you, Gary. We learned last year on the task force that it's a very tricky business to get a state law involving the private universities, and there's a fine line there. So I guess watch out for what you wish for with trying to get in there. As I guess my first take on this, and I don't know what the rest of the committee feels about an amendment like this, but Ms. McTague, comments? Senator Morris?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As a graduate of both public and private institutions, I would support your amendment. And I raise another question that I would like, maybe if not here, but to have clarified with the Legislative Council. And that it has to do with the opportunity grants and their distribution, which is inclusive of the privates.
Mm-hmm.
Can the commission, by rule, change what we have created by statute, I believe, with that opportunity grant? Because you have a commission that is representing public interests with no participation by the privates. And in order to protect what is now a balance, I think that's a question to consider for future.
I think it is.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, the independent college community, the nonprofit sector, has been part of that opportunity grant and other state student aid programs for, well, since 1969. The Oregon Student Assistance Commission that would be folded into this commission carries rulemaking authority over those grants. Some of the rules and conditions of those grants are already in statute, so you don't have to worry about that, and I don't have to worry about things such as no student aid grants can go to students who are pursuing degrees in religious occupations. So I don't think there's a problem there. I do think that what you were asked earlier, Representative Lindsay, about what cons there might be. There is a concern area regarding the Oregon Student Assistance Commission just being folded into this one. The Student Assistance Commission meets monthly. It manages over $100 million of state funds. It's a very complicated process to get that money out in a timely fashion to all the students and all the sectors to track all that. There's a lot going on in that very busy commission in those monthly meetings. If this Higher Education Coordinating Commission meets every 3 months in a very high-level policy arena, I think you should give some thought to how you will continue to conduct the very important business of the Student Assistance Commission inside this larger entity. I think it can be done. There probably needs to be some layering of responsibilities and maybe even a secondary citizens commission within the Higher Education Policy Group that actually manages all these rules and regulations regarding student aid in the state.
Further questions, comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I hope you can hear me. I'm trying to take notes on my computer. I'm new to this. Thank you for your testimony and your proposed amendment. I wanted to ask you, because I'm looking at the proposed amendment in the language which refers to the goals of the coordinating commission, and I wanted to ask you about a particular phrase that you talk about, a proposed adding a goal, utilizing the resources and enhancing the capacity of the state's private nonprofit educational institutions and other organizations, etc. I wanted to ask about, I certainly understand the resources part, but I wonder about the enhancing the capacity, what you anticipated by that language. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, there are about 40,000 students, FTE, utilizing the private sector. About 30,000 of them are in the nonprofit institutions and about 10,000 in the for-profit institutions in Oregon. There's room for more capacity. Some of those schools are very interested in growing. Some of them are where they want to be and don't plan to grow, but there has been steady growth over the last 20 years. In fact, there's been roughly 20,000 more students in the state system and 20,000 more students in the community colleges and 20,000 more students in the private sector over the last 20 years. And I have charts to show you if you want to go that route today or some other time. There's opportunity to do more. I've noticed over the last 10 years that my undergraduate population has shrunk of Oregonians. We had 57% of our undergraduates at our independent colleges were from Oregon 10 years ago. Last year it was 47%. I think a good part of that is because our state student aid has been quite low and has actually shrunk on an average grant basis for students going to independent colleges in the state. And that aid only goes to Oregonians, by the way, and as you know, low income. I think there's opportunity to do more there, to get more Oregonians into these institutions when they want to be there, to take advantage of that capacity, so you maybe have to build one less new state institution 10 years from now because you've got 20 or 30,000 students over in the independent colleges.
Thank you. Further questions,
Senator?
Comments?
Representative? Thank you for being here. As the parent of a soon-to-be graduating high school senior, I've been experiencing some sticker shock when it comes to the cost of private institutions, which she seems to be directing herself towards. But my question, I guess, is as you envision yourself in a collaborative role in trying to achieve the 40-40-20 goal, what kind of conversations are you having amongst the independent colleges about trying to hold the lid on the growth of tuition and room and board and all that kind of stuff in order to make yourself as attainable as possible for those students who would choose to go the independent route rather than the state university route.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, thank you for the question. Again, we can have an extended conversation about that. The national statistics are that the net tuition at private colleges in America has actually gone down in the last 8 years because the colleges have pumped so much more and found so much more in student aid to help students, so that the net tuition is actually down. I did pull up one graph because I was anticipating you might ask about that. In 2008, the cohort that started college in Oregon in 2004, looking at the cohort of the private colleges in my schools and at the state system, 4 years later in 2008, those students that graduated, 60% of the students that graduated that year at the state universities had an average debt going out the door of $20,291. The same cohort of students graduating from Oregon's independent colleges, 69% of them graduated with debt, and their debt was $23,000, a difference of $3,000 after 4 years. For some of the students who were forced to hang around for a fifth year because they couldn't get all the courses they wanted at a state university, this was actually a much better debt deal to have started at a private college, if that's what they chose to do. So I'm hoping that you will not be as shell-shocked as I was when I got the bills for my two children, but there is hope out there. And we spend a lot of time in my organization, for instance, coming up with ways to cut costs and to save money. We have a number of joint purchasing arrangements and arrangements that I know some of the state universities are looking forward to doing after you pass your bill, where we can go out and get much better rates on the open market for insurance and some things like that. Seven of my schools have formed their own self-insurance staff health insurance company, just so that they could control those costs better. There are a number of things that we're doing in that regard.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Mm-hmm. That is one of the drivers of the dual credit legislation, too, so that you have some credits in the bank.
Exactly.
If your kids would have had 60 credits coming out of high school, they bypass this.
Good deal. We'll be happy to take them.
Senator, I have a question.
Representative Dembo.
Thank you. Dr. Undine, so aside from issues related to tuition and financial aid, what do you see as the potential benefit of the independent colleges being part of the coordinating commission, or, you know, that the needs of the independents being part of that agenda? Can you think of any particular examples of ways in which the work of that commission would be enhanced by having that broad view?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dembro, my presidents frequently moan about not being asked to participate in high-level conversations about the direction the state's going and about things that could be done to make higher education more accessible. I think there a number of my schools are in the nursing programs, a number of them are in business MBA programs and other areas where it would be nice if the entire resource of the state was on the table as those decisions were being made about where we invest our public dollars going forward. We have, I think, over the years probably decided that we don't need any more law schools. We have two privates and one public, and that's probably enough. Some of those decisions get made consciously. Some of those decisions get made in the politics of the moment. I have often commented that the only place that we have a really open-ended conversation about the total needs, higher education needs of the people of Oregon, without having a sector bias, is in a legislative hearing room. That's the only place that it really happens. If you have a joint boards meeting and you've got people representing community colleges, people representing state universities, and people representing the governance of those institutions, there's no place where you can have, there's no venue to have the kind of conversations that I think you all want to be having under this proposed legislation, and we very much want to participate in that.
Thank you. I appreciate that response.
Okay.
One last comment, Senator Hass. You said be careful what you wish for. We've thought this language through very carefully. Some of my presidents are obviously very nervous. We don't want to get trapped into being regulated. We take the word independent very seriously. But I think that the people of Oregon take the word independent very seriously, too, and I think that there's a lot of reason to be comfortable that you would respect our independence as we would respect yours.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. I have a couple of people who have signed up to testify, and forgive me if I get these names wrong, but I've got Mary King, Ron Nevada. Mary King, Ron Nevada. And I have David Reeves. I don't know if you're all together or you want to... Okay.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Chair Haas, co-chairs Dembro and Johnson, members of the committee. I'm Mary King. I'm a professor of economics at Portland State University. I very much appreciate the opportunity to testify before you today as you take on the extremely important task of considering the future structure for governing the Oregon University system. The topic I came to talk about today that I'd like to call your attention to, both as an educator and a parent, is the critical need for considerations of quality to be foremost in any future mechanism legislated for assessing the performance of our public system of higher education. And so I'm here to advocate strengthening the language in Senate Bill 242 on the assessment of quality. Assessing quality is not easy and requires, I believe, the substantial ongoing input of faculty in each of the institutions individually. An effective consideration of quality must include some thought to inputs, to process, and to outcomes. Inputs, as you can imagine, include sufficient numbers of highly qualified instructors, adequate space, library resources, and technology. When we think about process, we're talking about pedagogical methods, and whether class sizes will permit the kind of thing like assignment of term papers, meaningful laboratory experiences, and active student roles. Outcomes that we might worry about include not only assessments of learning and measures of placement into good jobs, but also the creation of more capable citizens and future parents. Much of the value of a high-quality university education is not discernible at the moment of graduation. I myself have taught at Portland State for nearly 20 years, and during that time, as you know, we've been under tremendous pressure. Enrollment has more than doubled, and state support has been both unpredictable and very low by the standards of the other 50 states. That kind of pressure makes creativity and resourcefulness a necessity. As the saying goes, we've had to work smarter and harder, and I'm proud of the work that we've done to provide a high-quality public university education. But that kind of pressure can also take its toll on quality. The incentives are to cut corners, to increase class sizes, and to shift to less demanding and fewer assignments, to reduce offerings in the evenings when a relatively small group of students need to attend, to reduce the number of courses taught by highly qualified people, replacing them with graduate students and part-time faculty, to create online alternatives that are not as good as they should be, and to divert the attention of faculty away from the labor-intensive work of undergraduate education to pursuing research that appeals to external funders and to participating in fundraising campaigns. When we assess the performance of our universities, we cannot rely on a simple business model. To use an extreme example, Phoenix University is a successful business, but I would not say a successful university. Neither can we rely on simple metrics of degrees awarded, student credit hours delivered, or scores achieved on standardized tests. We have to ensure that the public universities are held to high quality standards, or we will shortchange our students, handicapping them in the labor market and impoverishing the future Oregon electorate. Oregon needs citizens capable of critical thinking, strategic problem solving, high-level analysis, effective research, and skillful writing and speaking. These higher-level skills are most often developed in classes offered by well-qualified faculty, that are not too large to allow student participation and challenging assignments for which faculty have time to provide detailed guidance and feedback. These higher-level skills are much harder to measure than whether a student has absorbed a certain number of facts. The facts change. I can't be the only parent who's had the unsettling experience of realizing that my understanding of something like dinosaurs is completely outmoded. They've changed all that. And an excellent education provides a skill set for a lifetime of facts that will change and demands that will change, and we need to assess education with that goal in mind. As Oregon creates a new mechanism for governing its universities, it's critical that quality figure prominently in performance assessments. Given the complexity of assessing quality, it's important that faculty be involved in an ongoing way at each of the universities in the OUS system. The reason that the effort should be based at each of the universities is that each institution has a unique mix of academic offerings, student body, and mission. For instance, my own, Portland State, is an access institution. We provide opportunity and excellent education to first-generation college students, to older students returning to finish degrees begun elsewhere, and urban professionals continuing their education, as well as traditional college students fresh from high school. Our success cannot be accurately measured with the exact same set of instruments that will best measure quality elsewhere. Public investment in public higher education has been the key ingredient to prosperity and well-functioning democracies for nations and states during the 20th century and is certainly essential for the future. I appreciate the moment to speak with you today.
Thank you.
Senator Haas, Representative Johnson, Representative Dembro, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Ron Narode, and I teach in the Graduate School of Education. I'm a math and science teacher educator. And I also want to address the issue of quality education in higher ed. I've worked in higher education for the past 30 years. The last 20 of which are at Portland State University, where I lead groups of prospective math and science teachers in our graduate teacher education program. I consider myself privileged to teach Oregon's new math and science teachers, both for what they contribute to our community and for what they have contributed to me personally over the years. But my students number in the hundreds, while theirs number in the thousands. A secondary teacher may instruct upward of 15,000 students over the course of her career, with perhaps 10,000 being the average. Given the age of the students and the duration of contact with each one, it's clear that teaching is one of the most influential careers in a community, and more so in a small community. I recall my reaction when I realized that I had a student in my class who was the daughter of a teacher I had 15 years before. Many teachers teach for generations. One cannot overemphasize the importance of really good teaching. At PSU, we work very hard to assure the quality of our graduates in teacher education. So here's a sampling of what goes into recruiting, selecting, educating, evaluating, and advocating for our teacher candidates. All of our candidates attend advising prior to applying, sometimes with several faculty. They then complete prerequisite coursework in education and psychology while visiting schools to be sure they are truly committed to their chosen profession. The candidates have their undergraduate and sometimes graduate transcripts evaluated by faculty from the math and science departments on campus to be sure that their content knowledge is up to standards. These faculty also write recommendations and requirements that must be met prior to entering our program. I would add that while I'm a high school math and physics teacher with a master's degree in physics and a doctorate in math and science education, I do not evaluate those students for the subjects myself. Rather, I defer to the faculty who know those subjects best and who know which courses the candidates should have. Additionally, the mathematics and science departments at PSU have made this advising a priority, as well as continuing to offer coursework for prospective teachers. The candidates must pass several tests of academic content prior to admission, and Oregon continues to have some of the highest cut scores on the math and science teacher tests in the nation. And finally, each student's file is read carefully by at least two faculty members, and each student goes through an interview that is also viewed by at least two faculty members. All of this review is necessary for one reason: to ensure that we admit only the most qualified candidates. We want all of our students to know that their peers are just as qualified and dedicated as they are. The teachers in the schools who mentor our student teachers want nothing less for the students in their classes, and the parents of those students want this as well. Licensing a poor teacher is a disaster, but removing a teacher candidate is no picnic either. Once in the program, students attend classes from mid-July and through the year before completing their master's degree the following July. Most of the coursework is conducted in the evenings because our students are in the schools observing and student teaching during the day and throughout the year. They're observed regularly by their mentor teachers, their university supervisors, by their professors at Portland State. I visited a student teacher in a Beaverton school this morning before coming here, and I will see another tomorrow in Hillsborough. We do advising, and we help our students find jobs before they complete the program. We also recruit and select the next class of students before the present class is finished. We do this in addition to our research, grants, service, and scholarship. Quality has many measures. President Obama stated that he wanted another 100,000 math and science and technology teachers in the next 10 years. That's a laudable goal, but it is not enough. In 2005, a group composed of business executives, college presidents, and other leaders called the Business Higher Education Forum issued a report that estimates that the nation will need 280,000 new math and science teachers by 2015. While these numbers are impressive, they're only the beginning of the story. Currently, we have about 25 prospective math and science teachers in our graduate teacher education program. Next week, I will interview 50 new candidates for the group that begins this July. And Portland State University has an enrollment exceeding 29,000 students. There's no doubt that we need more math and science teachers for our schools, but we cannot send unqualified teachers into the workforce. Our students expect a quality education. They want to become excellent teachers. We owe it to them to give them the quality they deserve so that Oregon's children can have the quality education they deserve. I ask that you please consider an amendment to Senate Bill 242 that addresses the issue of quality in higher education. Thank you.
Thank you both for your testimony. We'll deal with you in just a second, Mr. Rich, if that's okay. It's very thoughtful, and I just one man's opinion here was I think what the gist of this bill is removing some of the agency barriers to Portland State so that they don't have to go to the Justice Department to hire a lawyer for a parking lot on your campus, or so that they don't have to come to the legislature and wait around 2 years so that they can build a new building. And I don't think anybody here assumes for a minute that that will have an effect on quality that we all want. I've been following very closely what has happened in Texas over the last year, where some people have gone to one major university and they put dollar signs on how much a professor brings in because of his class, or how much one class makes for the university or loses, as if that's, the goal. And I'm very opposed to that, and I think most members of the task force were, indeed probably everyone up here. So, but I do thank you very much for your reminder, Professor King, and we'll take into consideration your thoughts about this amendment. But my sense is that in some of the mission statements and in some of the legislation, I think we're trying to keep the bar as high as you want it as well. Questions or comments for these two? Senator George?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Professor King, I was following you through your testimony, and I guess what kind of struck me as being odd is the first paragraph on your second page. And my view is that there are lots of institutions that add to our overall education in the country. Mm-hmm. And every student I've ever known that have attended, and you actually pointed out a specific private university, every student I've ever known that's gone to Phoenix University has raved about the flexibility, the quality of education, the price they paid. They're very happy with the product And Phoenix University has been able to make a profit and draw capital into the whole area of education. And it seems like private investment in education only enhances that many more citizens that are educated. And so this right here, you make the statement, you said Phoenix University is a successful business but not a successful university. And from my perspective, what makes me fearful of sort of putting all of this under one roof is that what I'd view in essence as an elitism, which is that is a private university that makes a profit, therefore somehow they're not a credible university. And from my perspective is I think we ought to be as broad-minded as possible about how we educate people, because everything is needed, all hands on board, on deck, to try to fix this problem we have. I travel all over the world, and this country is in big trouble because of its lack of education. And yet we take opportunities where people are bringing capital and putting it into our education system, and then we ridicule it. And I'm just a little, it just kind of caught me a little off guard, because from my perspective, that's what I fear most of all when we start talking about creating a university system where, in essence, we pick and choose who we like and don't like, who's bringing assets to what is a dire crisis, which is a lack of higher ed. And so if you could comment, I'd appreciate that.
Thank you. I think we have to be careful about accepting the idea that anything that is called education is education. You know, we do have to be sure that we are being critical about what we lend our support to. And I certainly would never make the statement that all for-profit education is bad. I'm also an alum of Stanford University. I think that's an excellent for-profit institution. They're doing very well. But I don't think it's an elitist thing to say we have to watch what our standards are, that the state of Oregon needs to be very careful about what education it supports and demands from its universities.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. Sure. The statement you made was Phoenix University is a successful business but not a successful university. And my personal experience is that people who have gone there have been very happy with the product, meaning they're happy with the product, their employers are happy with the product, and they got education in an environment where they weren't able to get education someplace else. To me, that is a successful university. I mean, I want people educated, and I want people where their employers, the person who is getting educated, has got the benefit of education. And to me, that there may be problems in every institution. I could point to some of my professors, at both the undergraduate universities I went to. I went to Pepperdine, I went to Oregon State. I could point to professors that I view as completely incompetent. But one little problem doesn't necessarily mean that the overall system is broken. And all that I'm saying is we just need to keep our mind really, really open, because we need everybody participating in this. And it makes me nervous when, in a testimony on a bill like this, it just makes a broad, bold statement, kind of unsupported, that I just think leads to this idea that there are certain types of education we like and certain kinds of education we don't like. And I just don't want to be there. I want us to be as broad-minded as possible in going into this endeavor.
I think we can agree. I think we can come to agreement that we need to evaluate our own university system based on research about what high-quality education is. And I think if I have misunderstood the quality of education being offered at Phoenix University, that we as a state can look there and appreciate that research, and I can have my own mind broadened on this point. What I understand about quality, I'm not there yet, but I would agree with you that we need to be open to reviewing whatever evidence we possibly can. Now, I do not think we can limit our evidence to something that you could call a satisfaction survey. I think those of us who live and die by student evaluations are really happiest when we get those evaluations that say, oh, she was really tough, but fair. You know, and we are fearful of the kind of satisfaction evaluation that says, oh, that was an easy and fun class, you know, and I got my credit and I'm out of there. So I'm with you on the broad point that we pay attention to every effective way that we can ensure high quality.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Appreciate it.
Hi, Chair Hatt,
Co-Chairs Dembro and Johnson, members of the Joint Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm David Reeves, President of the American Federation of Teachers Oregon. We have 13,000 members, including over 10,000 professionals in education among schools, university faculty, librarians, and teaching staff throughout the state. We've been monitoring the efforts of the task force and now the Joint Committee to redesign post-secondary education in the state. And actually, we're excited about some of the promising initiatives coming up. AFT Oregon's been involved in boards and commissions concerning education throughout the state with our members serving on them, and we look forward to future work with the legislature and any future boards. I'd like to briefly provide our views on the three bills before the committee. SB 253 seeks to grow an innovative program that makes college more accessible and affordable for students. And it has two components that faculty have been saying for a long time. Provide us with professional development, as the grants in the bill do, and help students with their cost of a higher education. And I think this is actually a great model. It's the only bill that has some kind of funding for that in it. And I think this is a great model for where we should be going with education in this state. Supporting faculty and our professional development, our training, and a further education. SB 254, I think a member of the Joint Committee got it right when he termed these are aspirational goals, 40-40-20. Faculty really do want our students to succeed. We do see that educated members of society contribute to society in all ways, and we want to see that. But, you know, we have to be realistic, and I'm glad some of the previous testifiers mentioned the elephant in the room, funding. The Post-Secondary Educational Quality Commission, the ones that established 40-40-20, also set some very explicit financial amounts that it would cost per student to realize those goals. And I've noticed that's not been mentioned at all here, and I'll take SB 254 for what it is, a very aspirational goal, and one hopefully we can meet when the economy revives, when we start reinvesting back in higher ed.
I think you got 253 and 254 just interchanged.
Okay, excuse me then. 253 then, thank you. But I think it's something we can start working towards once we start reinvesting in higher education. But it's just kind of the 1-2 punch to say we want higher education to meet these lofty goals and we're cutting you further this year. It's just, I don't see how it's going to happen. I've just got to get that out there. It hasn't been talked a whole lot, so let's be realistic about that. Finally, on to SB 242. We see a coordinating commission creating a very unified system in the state as a positive thing. I think that's faculty have kind of looked forward to that prominence for post-secondary education in the state, and that's a good sign. The mission statement, for example, the mission statement of higher ed in Section 17 is a great thing, and I think we should keep that in mind. That's what my colleagues are really talking about when we talked about quality. There's a lot of operational things in that bill, but let's really keep in mind when I talk to fellow faculty, my colleagues, those are the kinds of things they look at. It's not the operational side. It's really what goes on in our classrooms and our students' lives that we look at. So I think that mission statement in Section 17 is a very good thing. There are two issues I want to mention here that we do have concerns about. One is we do want to ensure that however tuition is set, it's a fair and transparent process, and we agree with the speaker from the Oregon Students Association that students should have a substantial voice in that process in order to make it fair and transparent. So we hope it's something all stakeholders, particularly students, have a voice in how tuition rates are set. One other thing, and this relates to what my colleagues were talking about, quality of education, is the performance compact. And when I talk to faculty, when I talk to my colleagues, this is the red flag they see. Not so much that it's a bad thing, it could be very positive, but it's very vague the way it's worded. It's probably the least discussed part of all this bill. I just see a few passing references to, oh, here's an example of what that could be. But it's really something that concerns us. You know, I think if I asked every member of the Joint Committee, what do you see as a performance compact? What specific goals? I might get a different answer from everybody on the committee. So this is what I want to speak to today. You know, we're excited, actually, and Representative Lindsay, we're not opposed to any change. This new model of funding that's not strictly on enrollment, but it's looking at a whole lot of factors that are in higher education. You know, this could be a really good thing. Things like affordability, student retention, successful completion of studies, student success, and quality of education. A new model of funding based on that is very promising. But when I hear that's really going to be rated by the performance compact, I just want to ensure that members of this committee and the legislature, when this bill gets passed, are very clear on what this performance compact is going to mean. You know, Professor King mentioned that higher education is not always a discernible thing, how to assess it. And this is probably our biggest worry, as Senator Haas said, the example of Texas, where they're tying specific dollar figures to how students are educated and what their degrees are in, and that's how they assess quality. We also see just a strict number figure. We want 200 degrees from your program in education by next year. That is not quality of education. It's an aspirational goal, but that does worry faculty when we see business standards that would relate more to production of widgets, of whatever you want to talk, apply to higher education, mostly because we haven't really been included in this conversation up to this point. You have the Gates Foundation, you have the Lumina Foundation, you have our consultants come in, but we really want to ensure that faculty, now that you are looking at quality of education, you're talking about a performance compact, that educators are included in what this is. You know, we are assessing the quality of education. Dr. Narode mentioned how he does it in his program just for the entry of students. Faculty, we as faculty are assessing our curriculum. It's an ongoing thing. A curriculum that doesn't have a self-assessment tool in it is not a valuable curriculum. People are, you know, faculty are assessing our curriculum, student success, our programmatic goals as we are going on. And that's my point. When we're talking about a performance compact, let's make sure educators are involved in it at the appropriate levels. You know, often it's at the programmatic level, and that we are making, you know, that we are making clear, and this is something we haven't really done so well as in academia. We haven't maybe made our case very clear about what we are doing, and now we're hearing words like accountability, as if we haven't been accountable up to now. I think we just haven't been clear about what we're doing. I think the American system of education is a success. As far as I know, it's where most students in the world still want to come to if they had a choice of what institution to study at, would be an American institution. And we are really strong on a lot of things like creating innovators, forward thinkers. And I just want to make sure that whatever mechanism is set up to determine this performance compact, and particularly how we assess the quality of education and the success of our students, it should include educators. I mean, this committee would not establish a board of medical standards and not have a doctor on it. You know, this if you look at some of the other boards in the state, Oregon Board of Architecture, 5 out of 7 members are architects. Oregon Board of Plumbing, 4 out of 7 are plumbers. Yeah, I just want to make clear to this committee, whatever mechanism is set up to assess the and I hate to use the word performance, but that's the word you've been using, the performance of our institutions, our programs, and our student success, it should include educators. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions or comments? Thank you. Thank you all.
Representative Lindsay, are you happy?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, good.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 242, 253, and 254. House colleagues, I don't know if you want to stay or not.
We'll go ahead then and close the House Subcommittee on Higher Education informational hearing as well, and we're welcome to stay or move on, whichever you choose to do.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 253. Colleagues, as you know, this is the easiest. Once a long journey starts with one small step. You know, this obviously puts in the 40-40-20 goal in state law, and if you look at the statute, you'll see that the bill that we're also eliminating a lot of verbiage that's in there. So I think what we're doing is updating some of the mission that we have here. And again, it is aspirational, but I do think it serves as a compass for policy decisions down the road regarding higher education. Does this get us closer to our goal or not? And as sort of a guiding principle. Senator Morris?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 253 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Or to dash one.
And are we working on dash one first?
Yeah, we have.
Okay. They already adopted it? We adopted it, right?
No, that was for 242.
Okay.
Sorry.
I amend that motion, Mr. Chair, to move the dash one amendments.
Senator Morris moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 253. A discussion? Objection? The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 253 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 253 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objections? Senate Bill 253 is passed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. You want to carry?
Sure.
Senator Morris will carry. We also have one bill to LC to introduce as a committee bill. I don't know if you have a
Mr. Chair, I move LC 3321, dated 1-18-11, as a committee bill. Adopted as a committee bill.
Senator Morris moves LC draft 3321 be introduced as a committee bill. Discussion? Objection? It will be introduced as a committee bill, LC 3321. Other comments? Thank you all for being so patient with these hearings. We will take more swings at this bill as amendments come in the coming weeks. We are adjourned.